You're listening to the OCD Stories podcast, hosted by me, Stuart Ralph. The OCD Stories is a podcast dedicated to raising awareness and understanding around obsessive compulsive symptoms. I do this through interviewing inspired therapists, psychologists, and people who have experienced OCD. Welcome to the OCD Stories. So welcome to episode 272, and in this episode, I interview Alka. Now, Alka originally shared her story in episode 102 of the podcast back in 2017. And she's come back on to give us an update. And specifically in this episode, we talk about her experiences of exposure and response prevention therapy, group therapy, support groups, meeting Margot, her therapy buddy, mixing exposure homework with valued activities, stopping asking for reassurance, how her husband had also suffered and decided to get therapy and process the 20 years of experiencing OCD in the family. We discuss her peer support training to become a peer support specialist, stigma and self-stigma, dealing with OCD during supporting her father through cancer treatment, and the OCD triggers this caused for her, the ideas of OCD treatment that helped her the most, and much, much more. And thanks as always to NoCD for supporting the show and the work that we do. NoCD are now operating in Australia as well as UK and USA. So good work to NoCD for continuing their expansion. And thank you to them for sponsoring the show. So thank you to Alka and thank you to you guys for listening. I appreciate it as always. And without further ado, here is Alka. On today's podcast, I have Alka Atspadeen. Alka is a scientist for a biotech company and a certified peer support specialist. Welcome back to the show, Alka.
Hi, Stu. Nice to be here again. It's a pleasure and thank you for having me.
Thank you for coming back on. So I don't know if you know the episode number that we did before, but it was quite a while ago now.
Yes, it's
102. Is it? Oh, wow.
It was in December 2017.
Okay, so... Yeah, a while ago. So yeah, you shared your story and you talked about a main theme of yours was contamination. So we unpacked that. So anyone interested, I'll put the links in the show notes and then go listen. So I guess just to start with those that have heard the story or those that, yeah, just anything you want to share about where you've been since then, since we spoke, or anything you've learned, just anything in general.
Yes, I'll share this. But then there's one thing first, which is really dear to my heart. I'd like to say that the OCD Stories podcast has been very integral to my recovery. And I'd like to thank you and everybody was on it who shared their experiences and also the therapist who shared the techniques for having been on. And because I would not be here if it hadn't been for those episodes. So thanks.
Thank you. No, it means a lot. And obviously we've got to know each other over the years and it's always been inspiring to see how you've used not just information on the podcast, but like the books you've read and the research you've done. And alongside your therapist, you've trialed some of these things and it's been great to see.
Yeah. So I think I will start continuing sharing my story where we left. Yeah. And so December 2017. So what was going on then? I always wanted to make something good out of my experience with the OCD, with therapy and recovery. And around this time, I had applied to become a certified peer support specialist. And the training started in February 2018 for this. And I'll come back to this. It's just a part which I wanted to share, and it was very important for me to have this because it was one of my goals which motivated me very much to push through the hard exposure and response prevention therapy, which I thought was not only hard, but also very interesting and very freeing. Mm-hmm. And so when I just to tell a little about the treatments which I have had or the therapies. So I had an inpatient or a semi-residential treatment for 12 weeks in summer 2016. And ever since then up to now, I have weekly therapy sessions with an ambulatory a CBT specialist who is the same one whom I had in the clinic. So that's how I have been doing it. And then after in 2018, I had the pleasure to take part in the first OCD camp in the UK together with you and some wonderful other OCD survivors. That's how we call ourselves, I think. And this was a very fun experience. And we had also an episode about this where I dared to touch a toilet seat. And I have to say this was a very important experience for me because the way I understand it now, it has been working like a retrieval cue for me. We have a photo, we took a photo of me doing this, and whenever I looked at it, I felt very strong to push through whatever would come along my life during my recovery journey. And so I started to work again as a scientist. I started the training as a peer support specialist, and I finished this my certificate in June 2019. And in between there, I also or before I finished there, I also took part in a how do you call this? In a group therapy, which was psychoanalytical. And this was along the ambulatory individual therapy sessions. And on looking back now, because I have a different perspective on my therapy now, I think everything that I did in addition to the exposure and response prevention brought me closer to my values and helped me become the person I'm now. So what I learned during group therapy, it was there were weekly sessions led by a psychiatrist, a psychoanalytical psychiatrist, with other patients, with seven other patients who did not have OCD. And the learnings I made there was, in the beginning, I tried to explain very hard how it feels and how it is to have OCD. And what I learned was most of the people there did not understand what it means. And I found out that because I actually wanted to reach those people and tell them about my feelings, what I did, I explained how OCD is, and nobody understood. They didn't get it. So what I tried then was to talk about how I feel or how certain situations in the setting make me feel. And this is an important learning for me along my recovery journey, that that if we talk about our feelings or especially about our vulnerability, it brings us so much closer. Yeah. So, and also the group setting was very important for me to also practice situations in a safe environment, which could happen outside, how to communicate. So I think group therapy, as hard as it is, and I left these sessions more than once crying, and was very very healing for me. Yeah. In addition to the CBT and ERP. And so this was a good experience I made retrospectively. And I stopped going there. Also, what I thought was really helpful, and I liked it very much. For a while, I went into a OCD sufferers support group. There, I met many wonderful people. In the end, I stopped going there because I wanted to progress more with ERP and doing this to recover. Mm. And others just wanted to talk about, which is fine, you know, what wanted to talk about how the compulsions are. And so I stopped this after a while. However, it was a good thing I went there because I met someone who is very dear to my heart, and I'm allowed to say her name. Her name is Margot, and she's an almost 83-year-old woman mm-hmm. who became my therapy buddy. She when I met her in the group, she had no therapist, and she was 80 at this time. And nobody wanted to treat her because they feared if she was doing ERP, she'll drop dead due to her age, principally. And they made her test her heart to make sure she will endure ERP. In the end, she didn't really find anybody who was treating it. And we were lucky that she got a place in a specialized OCD clinic who were willing to give her a therapy chance, and she did wonderfully. So she has had OCD for more than 50 years, went there for 12 weeks and continued to do the hard work afterwards in an ambulatory setting. We still meet, we still call each other, and we've been buddies all this time, and she has been on her recovery journey along or with me, and we've done wonderful things. So we've experienced what I described as expo and fun in the previous episode. Yeah. So we've decided we'll combine doing exposures and having fun and enjoying life at the same time. So we went to places which are difficult for us. For example, we sat together in a cafe and we had fun touching dirty money, rolling our pieces of chocolate on top of the dirty money, and then exchanging the chocolates in between ourselves from her hand to my hand, and then we ate it. And it was so funny. We were laughing. We were doing exposures, of course. Yeah. And we had a lot of fun doing it. So I'd like to share this because I think it's so important for a lot of people to hear that it's never too late to start therapy. So even if you're 80, you can have a wonderful, meaningful, value-based life if you do the hard work and keep doing it. I mean, keep doing the exposures and enjoy life and be self-compassionate about yourself. So this is how I met Margot. And we still meet, and we're still in contact. And we're just waiting for COVID to go away to hug each other again.
Yeah, of course.
Because she is a risk person, yeah. And she hasn't had her vaccination yet. Oh, wow. So that's another part of my recovery story, the support group. Then what also was really wonderful, and I'm very grateful for having had this or still having it, my family, my husband. And I've also learned a lot about having a loved one along my side when going through ERP and being on a recovery journey. So we decided, together with my therapist, that I would not include my husband's into exposures as a co-therapist. Hmm. he went along with me to places when we where we wanted to go, like a restaurant and so on, but not as someone sort of supervising me. And I think for us, for our setting, this was a good thing. We've also decided, or I have decided, and I think this is something I've managed really well, and I'm grateful to stop asking him for reassurance. Of course, not include him anymore in any of my compulsive behaviors, which I, and in the beginning, I still had. And it was for me, or for our relationship, it was good that I was the one not doing it anymore, because he would have probably given me reassurance if I had asked for it. Good. Not because he doesn't know what this is, but also because he is someone who likes to lecture a little. So his personality would think it's a lecture, but when in fact it would have been reassurance. So even when I had like an intrusive image or thought, something that was bothering me, I wouldn't really tell him what it was about. I only said, for example, you know, I'm triggered and it'll go away. And I'm not talking about this now at this point of time. So what we did instead is he accompanied me to the places I wanted to do an exposure together with him. For example, going to a restaurant, going to a pop concert, and eating out of from my fingers, or using a potty toilet. All these things, he went there with me to places to practice, and we had fun doing this, because these were actually normal activities that people have to do and which we couldn't do before. So relatives, having had my husband along my side, was very important, and having him not accommodate my OCD. And also, I think I didn't mention this intensively in the last episode. I wanted to state that the loved ones, my husband, had been suffering very much. So I was very glad when he decided to also get psychotherapeutic help to process what we've experienced all these 20 years of having had OCD together without knowing it was OCD. Yeah. And I think that's for him very freeing. Also, I experienced that we... both be having or considering that both of us had a very rough time, also brought us much closer again together, because we now started to talk more about our feelings. So this was, I think that's also very important on the journey. And then, of course, I've made a lot of progress compulsive behavior. So I would say in the meantime, I'm subclinical. I, of course, still have thoughts, images, urges, sensations coming along my way. However, I normally don't react anymore with overt compulsions, like excessive hand washing, showering anymore. I can pretty much control reassuring. I think I'm not doing this at all. However, what I notice is when things get stressy, and I've had a really rough year in 2020, I'll talk about this because I made a lot of learnings there. So how I notice the OCD wants to come back is when I have the urge to avoid, and then I'll try to catch that. And if I'm lucky, I'm doing it. And lately, since I'm not doing so many overt compulsions anymore, I had more rumination. And I also had an urge to recheck emails, for example. And catching this also is good. So I feel this. Yeah, this is how I feel. And then, of course, I have, as a lot of us, when it gets stressy, lapses and I would say lapses, maybe not relapses. I'm trying to be very self-compassionate with myself, so I would call it lapse.
Yeah,
it sounds nicer. So, but I of course have those. So that's and I can talk a little more about the methods I did to get where I am, because this is part of what I put into my work as a peer support specialist. In addition to having or getting the certificate as a peer support specialist in June 2019, I also went through a program to become a group leader for an anti-stigma training called, in the US or UK, it's called HOP, Honest, Open, Proud. This is a program which was, designed by Patrick Corrigan in the US a while ago, and meant to reduce the stigma in people with mental disorder, because stigma and self-stigma are like a second disorder in those affected with a primary mental disorder. Yeah. And it's also meant to help people support people in getting to a disclosure decision. Not everybody needs to disclose, not everybody wants to disclose, or it's probably also not wise for a lot of people to disclose, but it helps people to find out what they want and where they want to disclose, and then decide for themselves. Mm-hmm. And talking about disclosure, I can also share how I decided to disclose. So I have fully disclosed my OCD when getting back into my job as a scientist. I decided to tell my colleagues and also my management, and the case managers knew anyhow that I have OCD, and I was really relieved how well this was perceived. In fact, it was very freeing, not only for myself, but also for a lot of my colleagues who came up to me and said, you know, I have this and this, and I know someone who has that and that. And we could really talk about this. Ever since then, we've been talking very freely about mental disorder, which I think is very, very integral for a good teamwork, even in a scientific, or especially in a scientific company. And in addition to this, from then on, it was possible for me to really use my workplace environment as a field to do exposures during the day. There were so many, because my workplace was involved in my avoidance behavior. So, and of course, also my colleagues had been accommodating my OCD without knowing that I had OCD. Because I also didn't know. So they had been opening doors for me, brought me fresh forks when I looked at them bewildered, or they went detours with me when I didn't want to go pass by a construction site, as I was very scared of asbestos falling down on my head. So they had been accommodating my OCD. And from then on, I was really sharing with them, let's go do this in a normal way. Could you please help me? And we had a lot of expo and fans together, eating with fingers and going swimming. And it was very freeing for me, and a lot of fun for all of us. And I love my colleagues very much. for having been so compassionate with me. And this was when I disclosed the first time. I disclosed also in a lot of group settings where I, for example, took some courses and I disclosed my disorder with friends. I have to say I didn't make a lot of contact with stigma, however, a few times. And so I know from my own lived experience that stigma hurt me much more than having OCD. And experienced this more than once, I have cried for this. And this is why I wanted to disclose and talk about it, because whatever we talk about gets smaller and brings us closer. And anyhow, if then the stigma persists or these people don't get or I cannot tell anymore to those people, I either start to think, are those the right people where I want to have contact to, or I just stop talking about having the OCD. And there were not many people like this, but a few times this happened. And stigma, and now I'm looping back to my very first or yeah, I think stigma was what kept me from asking for psychological help from the beginning, because I was brought up in a way that you just didn't have mental disorders. You know, I mean, nobody was talking poorly about those, but it was just that something that we did not have. So, and that's probably why I, for such a long time, didn't seek help. And when I asked for help for the first time, having had about 10 years of OCD without knowing it in 2006, it was very hard for me to go someplace. I even went there on a Saturday so that nobody found out I was going and having a doctor's appointment for my mental unwellness. I didn't have a name for this, just that I was very scared. And then, unfortunately, in 2006, I met a psychiatrist who didn't know about OCD. And I wasn't given a diagnosis. I wasn't given the right treatment. And somehow I stopped going there after 8 times, which was good for me. So I didn't make any bad experiences. And from then on, it took me another 10 years to get again to this point to seek for help. And this tells how much the stigma around mental disorder kept me from asking for help and from accepting help. And I think that's really very this is very, very detrimental to a lot of people, and especially it has been detrimental for me. And in addition, maybe to the stigma, what also kept me from looking for help much earlier, although I was suffering very much due to the OCD, was that apparently I've had high functioning OCD. So I could do a 40-hour job and in addition have 6, 7, 8 hours of compulsions in the night after my job with all the thoughts all together. And I went to work right until before entering the clinic. So I think those two facts kept me from getting help earlier. However, I think the stigma is something that could be avoided if people treated mental health differently and talked more about it, more openly, and that it's just okay to have a mental crisis and disorder during your lifetime. That's not an exception. So So this is why I took this training as a group leader. I'm not working as a group leader for the HOP program at the moment, because normally you're supposed to do those sessions over 3 days. And at the moment, I don't have the time. But this is also something that I'm including in my peer job, in my job as a peer support specialist. So, and now coming, is it okay to continue with the work as a peer now? Or do you have any questions?
Yeah. Well, I guess you mentioned you were going to talk about 2020.
Yes. Oh, you're right. Yeah. You're right. I start to forget this year, which,
yeah. A lot of people have, I think.
I know. Yes, 2020, or I have to say, a rough time for me started in November 2019, when my dad was diagnosed with a highly malignant lymphoma cancer. Mm-hmm. And it was especially, I mean, cancer is very hard for everybody. For me, it was very hard due to my OCD theme, which is cancer. And having had, so I've spent all my life actually to prevent my family or myself from getting a disabling disorder, cancer. This was always what's my core, the content of my worries was getting cancer. However, the core fear behind this, and this is what I learned in 2020, the core fear is not actually having cancer itself. The core fear is what Jonathan Grayson, for example, always described as the world does not end when getting cancer. When having been in the throes of OCD, for me, my world ended with the thought of having cancer, with the word cancer. Everything went black, and I went and did a compulsion at this point of time. So in 2019, cancer had really happened to me, and there was no running away. And I was brought very close to my core fear behind the cancer, which is lying or being somewhere alone in a hospital, suffering from a deadly disorder, all alone, a lot of tubes, a lot of infusions, and principally suffering all alone. This is my core fear. And I felt this really hard when my dad was diagnosed. However, I decided at this point of time, because I had been I had learned a lot of things about ACT then, and about values-based behavior during my therapy, that my value is actually to not run away anymore, but to help my family, my dad, get therapy and hopefully be cured from this cancer, even if I have to go into hospitals to see him, to see whatever made me run away from these places before. And I was very lucky, because I could manage to support my parents during this hard time. I went to the hospitals. I was not perfect. I had a few lapses. I felt I wanted to avoid situations. But in the end, what pulled me through there was always thinking about the choice I have, the choice between running away and acting upon my values, which was to go there and assist my dad during this time and my parents during this time. And again, looping back, of course, my therapy had prepared me really well for this point, because I had been practicing doing exposure and response prevention before, all these years before, and I had actually prepared by going to hospitals, using the bathrooms there, going to the cafeterias, pushing elevator buttons, going up and down different hospitals even in my area. So just really practice. I had been practicing in hospitals. However, when you really have a real situation, then it's even tougher. But I was prepared by ERP to do this. And then after a while, of course, COVID came in addition to the cancer. My dad went in and out of hospital, receiving chemotherapy. I was also my OCD. I had thoughts that the chemotherapy is toxic also. So this was also triggering for me, not only the cancer itself, but the chemotherapy, the radiation, everything. And then in addition, this hospital was being reconstructed. So asbestos came in addition. So all of this was in this place. My dad went in and out, and then COVID came along. And I was astonished because my OCD didn't latch on to COVID at all. It was really occupied by its own topics and didn't change to COVID. Of course, I was avoiding a little in the beginning, and I had a few thoughts that came and said, well, you mustn't, apparently you're not taking this serious enough, Elke, you know. And I thought the OCT tried to give me some moral thoughts about this, but in generally it was not really affecting me too much, because probably there was so much other distress going on in our lives. So my dad went in and out of hospital. We had some wonderful times with my parents. We, even with the COVID, we could go in between the therapies to and sit together in the summer in garden restaurants and enjoy nice food. And we had very intensive talks. And actually, I think this year, 2020, with my parents, with my dad, brought me closer than ever to my dad. And we had a very intense relationship. My dad, he is an avid user of WhatsApp, you know, so we were texting all the time. We were actually texting a lot about feelings. And I've never really talked about feelings with my dad anymore. And my dad had never talked so intensely with me before about feelings, how he feels, that he's scared, that he is hopeful. And I could use also what I had learned through my own therapy to guide him or to support him during this tough time. And it was a really wonderful time because we got so close. And I realized how much the OCD before this happened to him and me, before my therapy, had kept us from getting closer, because of course my compulsions and my avoidance behavior was really keeping us from getting closer, and I acted in a weird way. He was accusing me of being he was noticing I was acting really weird, and he used some hard words with me because my behavior was just triggering him in a way, and he couldn't understand. Nobody knew I had OCD. So 2020 brought us really, really close, and I will never forget this year which I had with him. And I'm very grateful for having gone through CBT, ERP, and in addition especially for having learned to find out how I feel and to be able to express how I feel, and also to be self-compassionate and compassionate with him, and try to feel how he might feel in the situation. And he expressed this to me. So this was a nice year in this regard. At the end of 2020, my dad got progressively worse. And unfortunately, and I'm still in grief now, he died in January 2021. And I'm still processing all of this now. But looking back, I'm more than grateful for what we had in 2020. And I don't want to miss this last year with him. Also, now besides the feeling, when I look at my whole OCD story, I was very surprised, because this was a very tough exposure all year long for me. Mm-hmm. I was very surprised that I could deal with situations which I would have never thought before. And I'm very grateful that, my therapist and all the learnings I had from, for example, the OCD Stories podcast brought me so far that I could handle this. The world was not stopping with cancer. It continued, and we had a good 2020 together, looking back. And in addition to what we experienced there together, my dad and myself in 2020, COVID had an impact on me insofar also that I, from one day to the other, I had to stay at home in my home office. For me, this was very hard. The OCD did not intensify through this, but one of my resources is to meet people in person, and distancing and being in home office. I have been in home office now for almost a year for my scientist job, which is really tough because it deprived me of my resource, which is having personal contact with many people. Yeah, we have video and all of this all day long, but it's
not the same.
It's not the same. So I was really grateful that during this time, I could still do my job as a specialized peer support coach, or qualified peer support specialist in person. And I went there and... So I could have the contact there, and should I,
yeah. Yeah, just it'd be good to hear about your journey of becoming a certified peer specialist, I should say, like the training, and then what you've learned from the people you've worked with, like, I guess, learned both intellectually, but also like what you've learned for your own journey, because I'm sure you've learned a lot for yourself too.
Yes. Yeah. So this is a training which was initiated by six European countries not a long time ago. It was initiated between 2005 and 2007, and it was meant to get a qualification for peer supporters, for persons who have their own experience with having had a mental disorder and having had a therapy and being on their recovery journey. And it was they wanted to standardize the qualification program. So in the German speaking countries, this is called EXIN, EXIN, which means experienced involvement. That's English. And it means that persons can apply to become peer support specialists who have their own experience with it. So you've have to have this. And then you go through this program. The main concept of this program is, of course, that recovery is a way of living and is an attitude. And the qualification includes 12 training modules, each of 3 days. And after each of this module, there is a written reflection, which we have to hand in. And the modules, for example, contain fostering health and well-being, and then having group meetings at eye levels between professionals, between individuals diagnosed with a mental disorder and family members, so those three, empowerment, then experiences and participation. Then one of the main topics, of course, is recovery and recovery-oriented assessment. Exploring ourselves is a huge part, and not only exploring ourselves, but also sharing our own experience with a second person who has a different mental disorder, and then sharing all of our experiences with the group. So the wealth of this training is actually the wealth of all the lived experiences from the group of people, which is normally very diverse. You have different ages, different sexes, different background, different social status, and also different disorders there. And Then the last parts consist of providing advice and accompanying individuals, crisis intervention, and then also some legislation. In addition to these trainings, there are 300 hours of self-study where we try to find out more about ourselves. We have learning groups and role plays. There are 2 internships which have to be passed. They consist of a total of 190 hours. So for myself, I've decided really early, or my wish was very early, to work in a place where people affected with OCD and anxiety disorders need my support. So I chose internships in 2 CBT clinics, which specialized in these disorders, which was a fantastic experience for me. And I'm very grateful for all the support from the professionals which I received there, and who were very open to having peers in their departments. It's not, up to now, it's not really too common. It starts to become more and more, but it's not really too common. So I was lucky I found these places. And after these internships, where we had supervision and intervision, also we had to write written reflection papers. There were writing assessments. And in the end, we had to compile a portfolio with all of our experience throughout the whole training time, which is 1.5 years. Yeah. So it's very intense. And at the end, there is a presentation, which we have had to give in addition. And I also took 2 supplementary modules, which were offered in my area. And the job assignments that can be filled with certified peer support specialists are also very diverse. So you may either work directly with patients in inpatient or in residential departments or semi-residential. You may work with in outpatient centers, daycare facilities, in sheltered workplaces, in residential homes, for helplines, for acute teams, or for home treatment. And you may facilitate and lead focus groups, support groups, or work in lecture and education, for example, at universities, or if you're invited as a speaker, you can co-work for quality assurance teams when, for example, new departments are being planned at psychiatric clinics. I think that's quite good that they include now the input from people with lived experience. Or you can work in public relations, do advocacy, official advocacy. Anybody can do it, but this is where it's structured a little. And then, of course, in raising awareness, for example, at school or in workplace environments. So it's very diverse, and it's meant to be a job that is paid for, of course. This was the training, and luckily enough, I got offered a position in the place where I had gone through my second internship, which is in Basel, Switzerland, at the University Psychiatric Clinic in the behavioral therapy, in the residential behavioral therapy department, which has a strong focus on ACT and applying, of course, exposure and response prevention in combination with ACT. I started working there part-time. It's mostly every 2 weeks in June 2019. For me, it was I've loved this place from the first day, not the place. I've loved the team, and because the team is very open to peer support specialists, and I was included into the team from the get-go. I mean, I didn't have any issues. In addition, of course, having had my own lived experience, I'm also very close to the group of residential patients. They more or less change every 12 weeks, because this is how long treatment is normally, 10 to 12 weeks or 8 to 12 weeks. And my work there consists of delivering psychoeducation courses in a group setting. And I'm doing two kinds of courses. I have a group for all of the patients, which is a recovery, a group about recovery, and another group about stigma. These groups normally last for an hour only. And then I have, with the help of the OCD Stories podcast and all these wonderful people who were on it and the therapists, I have compiled 5 modules of psychoeducation for OCD specifically. Mm-hmm. And I'm delivering this to the group every 2 weeks. So if you're there as an inpatient, you normally get to know all of the 5 modules. However, it's not only for the patients. So we're a training institute. So whenever some of the nurses in training or anybody who loves to join the group and peek into what I'm telling there as a peer, they're very welcome to be there as well. At the moment, it's a little difficult due to COVID. We cannot have so many people in the group. We still do it in person with masks and at a distance, of course, according to the legislature, the whatever the health authorities have as requirements. And then in addition to these groups, I also have one-to-ones with whoever wants to talk with me, either about general topics as a peer, about recovery and maybe also about the training, or people with OCD, they come and want to go more into detail about their topics and know from me how I would compose an exposure. And And we're all at eye level. So within the team and with the patients, because this is also in a concept of ACT. So I can feel very much that ACT is within the whole department. So we're not, one person is not better than the other. So the patient is as much worth as the therapist. And we are also going through the same, we're very open to share our experience as human beings. And I think this makes the department so fruitful for the patients also. They do the hard work, but it's all values based. And a lot of mindfulness is also applied there to notice the feelings in the first place. So you can... Because if you're not noticing them, it's very hard to get closer to ourselves.
Exactly. Yeah.
So this is the work I'm doing. I love it very much. It's not. It sounds here, or it might have sounded a little like I'm lecturing. What I'm doing actually is I share a lot of my personal experience in these psychoeducation courses. So the peer work is something I'm giving back to the patients, because it's really motivating to see she was there and now she's on her journey and she has a wonderful, meaningful, values-based life. However, the work, of course, also motivates me very much. So I, for example, share very openly what is going on in my life. So I've shared my dad's cancer, how I had relapses, how I managed to overcome them with exposure and response prevention and being self-compassionate. So sometimes I also, because I think what is important also is being a role model also makes me accountable for my own behavior. So I'm sharing, I have an issue, for example, I need an investigation, whether I have colon cancer or not. You know, this is something you do every once in a while. I've never done this before, but I wanted to do this for a long time. So I was sharing with a group of patients. I really feel the urge to avoid, because I don't really want to know, you know, because I'm scared of what if something bad is there growing in my body, you know. On the other hand, my value is I want to take care of my health. And I'm sharing this with the patients. I'm telling, I really want to get this appointment now. And then when I'm back, so I did this. And 2 weeks later, when I was in the department again, in this group, I shared, oh, I got an appointment now. So I'm also showing that I'm accountable for what I'm doing. And it's so these are the things I'm sharing there. And from the contents that I deliver in the psychoeducation courses, I share whatever has helped me. I mean, there's a lot of about how OCD works and how you do exposures and so on. But I really also share what's my lived personal experience with what I've learned through the podcast, for example. And there are a number of things which I thought were really fascinating. First, the whole willingness and openness thing to experience difficult emotions, and then having the choice to take values-based decisions. And I remember my therapist talking to me about, you're the bus driver of your life, which is actually, I think he took it from the passenger on the bus metaphor. And this is what is really what resonates with me very much, that I really feel I want to be the bus driver of my life, irrespective of all the passengers, you know. And I started to draw all of these metaphors also, because I investigated my creativity again. So I have a lot of my own drawings in the handouts for the patients. So being the bus driver is one that resonated with me, taking values-based decisions. I think it's very helpful. Let me quickly look, because I have a few also with the names of persons which I want to thank for those. What I also like is doing the leap of faith. I love this image of the mountain of anxiety and the person who wants to commit to do an exposure, standing on top of it and having to jump down into this ocean of uncertainty. And in this ocean of uncertainty is our value. And of course, the therapist or whoever is on your side is not telling you, go jump, it's safe down there. He or she is going to tell you, maybe it's going to work, maybe it's not going to work. You have to do a leap of faith. So I think, and this is what I also experienced, it's very hard in the beginning, and probably people who have OCD, they know how hard you have to argue with yourself to jump in, and you're not knowing whether it's going to be safe down there. The only thing you know, there's your value and there's where you want to get. And so the leap of faith is very is one of the images I'm using. I love to mention the B-trap from Dr. Alan Wegg, that you will need to look this up, that the bee needs to fly through the darkness, so to say, into the wrong direction to go to come to freedom. And this is what we're doing when we're doing exposure and response prevention. It feels like the wrong direction in the beginning. So I love this metaphor. We talk a lot about the reassurance circle and how there is a paradoxic effect in increased doubt, reassuring, and then having the relief which is a negative reinforcement, and how to deal with uncertainty. And here I really love the way Reed Wilson was describing it, with the content of the worries, which are trash. Because it helps. I mean, it helped me so much. And then also that I don't fight against the OCD. I have a mental game. This is the game thing. I was fascinated by how he explained this in one of your podcasts, with a mental game. Not fighting it, but treating it as a game. Okay, uncertainty, I want you. You know, you don't feel nice, but I want you. And then I'm adding what Jonathan Grayson says, and if the worst is going to happen, I will be able to deal with this. The worst being like in hospital, dying from cancer all alone for me. And I also love the description by Kimberly Quinlan about the exposure sandwich. She had this in one of her Facebook talks, where uncertainty and self-compassion wrap the exposure. So you start your exposure being self-compassionate, which doesn't mean you want to avoid, I mean, which means you're going towards your fears. And you must have uncertainty before it. doing exposure where you know it's going to be safe is not an exposure. So the uncertainty must be before you have anticipatory anxiety. Then you expose yourself without avoidance, of course, reassurance and all these things, without mental, without mini rituals. And then in the end, you have this post-processing anxiety. You have the uncertainty, will I die or won't I die? Maybe I will, maybe I won't. And also the self-compassionate component, which is the wrapping of this sandwich. I love it very much. So I drew the exposure sandwich as well. And the other concept, which I think is really important when doing exposures, and I try to deliver this also or share this with the patients, is because it has helped me so much, is the inhibitory learning part of the exposure and response prevention. So putting variation in your exposures, not having a hierarchy, but having a to-do list. What else is it? Combining fear cues, for example, reading something about something that scares you and then doing it. Variation, I think I did a lot, I described. Then also letting the feelings come and give the feelings a name. And the important thing also for me was, which I did very much, to have retrieval cues in the end that you can remember if you manage to surprise yourself with a different reaction than normal, with, like, for example, what I did with my dad in hospital, I had a few photos which I took from this. And for me, photos are retrieval cues for successes. And actually, I have a lot of photos from toilets on my mobile phone, different toilets, because I was so proud of being able to use toilets. And it was not in a compulsive way that I did these photos, because I have no checking compulsions. So for me, it was pure joy to have this, but they work for me as retrieval cues. Or, for example, when I'm with someone and we eat from our fingers and we enjoy our time, I have photos. So photos and writing diaries and having, those two things helped to motivate me. Yeah. And I think this is what is meant by retrieval cues, where I can remember I did this before, I managed to be in the situation or in a similar situation before. So why shouldn't I be able to also now face this other fear? Yeah. I can do it, you know. So this is what I want. And of course, one last thing is, it really matters how I talk with myself. So this brings self-compassion into the play. And I have, my therapist had been working on this with me before. Before, I've never really thought this is so important, but it really matters so much how I talk with myself.
Yes. Yeah.
And Sharla Nicely also did Kimberly Quinlan is just wonderful, and I'm waiting for her book to come in the autumn about this, I hope. And then also Sharla Nicely was talking about the shoulders back.
Yep.
Attitude, that if you put your shoulders back and you tell yourself, go for it, you can do this, you know, it's hard, but you can do this. I think self-compassion is very, very important. And I think what I also wanted to share is, maybe it's a little out of place here, but I think motivation is a big part, and I have learned recently with the help of my therapist what makes your life hard can be used as a resource. So I'd like to share, for example, do you know about the inner drivers? Like my inner driver, for example, is be one if one is you must make sure people love you, you know, be please everybody. So that's the please everybody driver and the be perfect driver. And there are more drivers, but for me, those are the strongest, especially the please everybody driver. And if I look back on my recovery journey, and I think my therapist has known this for a long time, because we've used this as resources for me to push through therapy. So be perfect and work hard, you know, can be used as a resource if you really have to push through the hard work, doing many, many, many exposure and response prevention practices. And I've done so many over months, years, you know, and it was hard work. Still is sometimes, but it's so much less. And then also, so we use this as a resource for my therapy. And then also the please others. I love to work in teams. So that's the nice part about the please others. People like to work with people who please others. So therapy is teamwork, especially behavioral therapy. So we use this because I just loved, I've always loved to work with my therapist and his team. You know, it was for me, it was, I was sort of the co-therapist. I was my own therapist and we did this together. You know, we, it was not about me having this disorder. It was more, we do something very valuable together. Yeah. This was driving me. What I noticed recently was that if the drivers get too strong, it can backfire. Yeah. So, for example, the driver be perfect can totally backfire in therapy if you try to do the perfect exposure, you know, or maybe the OCD when you go towards the end of your therapy, they might tell you, well, if you're not doing 10 every day, you will have a relapse. You know, so, and this is where we're working now together to get this driver a little quieter, and also the other driver, which is be nice to everybody because otherwise people don't love you anymore, you know. And also, so it's also take care of, I can be nice to myself. I don't always have to please others. Yeah, people like me even if I don't produce any good work for them or so. Yeah. So I think that's an interesting concept as well.
Yeah, I think it is.
I think I took us a little off the topic, but
I think it's definitely worth sharing. It's all part of knowing yourself, and then you can always tailor things to them.
And this is also about recovery, you know. It's of course, recovery is to get the symptoms down, you know, to be able to live a life, a full values-based rich life with, of course, less symptoms, because symptoms are very, very tough to deal with. But it's also to get, it's a lot about getting to know ourselves. And I think that this is just the wonderful part about recovery, which I love so much. So I think there is a lot to, there's so much interesting going on during recovery, a therapy in recovery from OCD. The first part is, of course, the playfulness in the experience, the creativity and the surprises. I love surprises, you know, like surprising myself with what I can do. And the second part is, I'm getting to know myself. You know, I changed. I became softer, and the self-compassion component increased in myself. It feels a little sad to talk about this, you know, because I wasn't really a poor, bad person before. However, I just feel so much richer now. You know, so much, it's so, my life is so much more colorful. And it's full, you know. And I feel I got older during therapy. However, I feel so much younger. I feel free and creative now. And I know it's a chronic disorder, so I'm not blind to this. You know, I know it's chronic, and I had a few episodes with relapses, where I had to work for 2 weeks to to deal with this, you know, with exposures, because relapses happen in recovery. And this is what I'm clearly also sharing with the patients as a peer support specialist. I've only met one patient who did not like that I told this, because they wanted to hear I'm here for 10 weeks and then it's gone. But I think being open about this, that it's a chronic disorder, and I think probably 95% still have thoughts, images, urges, sensations when they when they're on that journey. I know one person who claims they don't have any of this anymore, and the rest, they all share my experience.
Yeah, exactly. And it's normal to have intrusive thoughts. Most people have it. Look, thank you so much. That was so much detail, and just really good to hear the update on your journey, everything you've learned. And then it's great to hear your side of becoming a certified peer, because if anyone's interested, especially in the European countries, you know, you've just kind of outlined some ways. It's great to hear what you're doing in the groups and the psychoed, and what you've learned from the podcast. It's brilliant. So I have no more follow-up questions, because you've been so detailed. So what I will say, that's okay. If you could pick up the phone and call your 20-year-old self, what would you tell her?
Oh, that's really easy and short. I would tell her, you're enough. Mm. Just what I would tell the 9-year-old, the 56-year-old. Okay. Yeah, you're enough.
Nice. I like it. And then you've got a billboard in Germany or Switzerland. What do you want written on that billboard?
One thing resonates very much with me. I just received a little booklet with some of these quotes, and actually I tore one out, put it on my desk, and it says, you don't have to do what everyone else is doing. Because recently I felt some pressure to be going on Instagram and doing as everybody else is doing as a peer. And I feel maybe I don't want this. Maybe I just like it the way I'm doing. I have my peer job. I love it. Why should I feel pressed to do more, to be like everybody, you know? Yeah. And I really appreciate what the others are doing. You know, they're wonderful. But
you got to do what's right for you.
Everyone else is doing.
Exactly. Yeah. Very much so. You got to be yourself. Lastly, is there anything else you wish you could have said today?
Oh, no, not really. I talked so much. Maybe that I wanted to share with people who it will so get so much better.
Yeah.
When you're doing the hard work with courage, curiosity, playfulness, and self-compassion.
Yeah. Good way to end. Yeah, I like it.
You can free yourself. Yeah. And freeing does not mean having no thoughts, images, urges anymore.
Yeah, absolutely. Yeah, freedom.
But you'll be able to deal with this and have a wonderful values-based life. Mm. Yeah.
Yeah, good words, strong words to end on. Thank you so much for sharing your journey. It's been wonderful to kind of see you change and grow and evolve and hear it. So thank you.
Thank you, Stuart, for everything you've been doing and being on this journey with me. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
Thank you for listening to this week's podcast. If you enjoy the OCD Stories podcast and would like to support us with a one-time tip/donation, please go to theocdstories.com/support. All tips, no matter how large or small, are greatly appreciated. Please subscribe and rate the show wherever you listen to the podcast. Thanks also to NoCD for sponsoring the show. For more information, please click the link in the episode description. A quick disclaimer, this podcast is not therapy. It is not a replacement for therapy. Please seek treatment from a trained professional. And until we speak, take care.